This is your Word by Word Conversations with writers host Gil Manser and our studio engineer Adya White from Northern California Public Media, KRCB-FM. Before listening to today's show, I suggest you might like to pack your bags for both your honeymoon and an African safari. You will soon find out why, because our guest is the New York Times multiple bestseller and winner of over 20 writing awards, Rhys Bowen, with her latest Royal Spinus book, Life and Death Among the Cheetahs. Rhys Bowen was born in the town of Bath, England, into a half-English, half-Welsh family, which apparently she thinks is important that we know because it's in her bio online. She studied at London University and started a career at the BBC as a drama studio manager. While working on a very dull play, she decided to write one herself, marched into the office of the head of BBC Drama at the age of 22, and gave him her script. They produced the play, and Rhys moved to Australia to work for Australia Broadcasting. She met her future husband, and the couple moved and settled in San Francisco, California, where they raised four children. Rhys wrote children's books using her married name, won several awards, and began writing books for young adults. She was selling 500,000 copies when she turned to writing mysteries using her pen name, Rhys Bowen. She set her Constable Evans series in North Wales near the Mount Snowdon area, where she had spent many vacations in her childhood. After visiting Ellis Island, she created the spunky Irish lass, Molly Murphy, whose first book, Murphy's Law, won an Agatha Best Novel Award. Rhys created a second heroine named Lady Georgina as part of her Royal Spinus series. Georgina is distantly an heir to the British throne, but is flat broke and trying to make her way through the Great Depression. The series was a bestseller, and Not in Nice was nominated for a Bruce Alexander Agatha and RT Reviews Award. In 2012, it won the Best Historical Mystery in the Agathas. Rhys drew from her life in England to write the series, and when not writing, she likes to paint, sing, play the Celtic harp, travel, and spoil her grandchildren. Rhys Bowen, I want to welcome you to Word by Word.
Well, thank you very much, Gil. Nice to be here.
This is a fun story at multiple levels. For one thing, it's a historical novel, and there's all kinds of little saucy tidbits that you sprinkle throughout about what was really going on at the time. You begin with the honeymoon on board a canal boat. So tell us a little bit, because the previous novel, which I haven't read yet, is about the wedding.
Well, the previous novel was called Four Funerals and Maybe a Wedding. So you might guess that by the end of the book, we finally might get Georgie and Darcy together. Well, that was the 12th book. We've been through 11 books with the will they, won't they, will they ever get together. So finally, I thought I'd better marry them off, because else people would die of frustration. So, yes, it's the book before starts with plans for the wedding, everything in place, everybody looking forward to it, and then one thing after another goes wrong. As you can tell from the title, people die, situations change, and you begin to wonder whether Georgie actually will be alive to get married by the end of the book. But this is a big spoiler, and if you haven't read it, close your ears right now, but she does get married by the end of the book.
And we already told them that.
We already told them that, yes. So this book picks up exactly where the last one left off. The end of the last book has them going off together to this houseboat on the Thames to be quite alone for a few days.
And they are alone for a few days, but there's some problems.
Well,
they run out of champagne.
Yeah, this book starts, and it shows how wonderful it was to have champagne on ice and oysters and all the things you dream about. And now 3 days later, Georgie is craving a cucumber sandwich, and there are no cucumbers, and there's no fresh bread, and the ice has melted, and the smallness of the boat is beginning to annoy both of them. So they have to come home, and Georgie thinks, oh, great, is this the end of my honeymoon? It's not exactly very long and not exactly very romantic.
Right. Well, the husband keeps hitting his head on the beams of the boat, too,
which doesn't
help.
Have you ever been on one of those boats? They're awfully low.
Oh, they are. They're quite low. Well, they have to fit under the bridges.
Yes, they do. Yeah.
In fact, there's some I've seen where the smokestack bends over so they can, you know, glide underneath them.
Yes, yep.
So we're there, and she's had a wonderful and very carnal time together for 3 days, and then reality sets in. There's no ice box, et cetera, et cetera. So she goes on to dry land again and finds it odd to stand there at first because it's not moving.
Well, I don't think it moves very much on the Thames. You haven't got enormous waves coming up and down the Thames.
Oh, I thought there were giant, you know, tsunamis coming up and down. Huh? And one thing leads to another. She goes around and she visits people we've met before in earlier books, including her – is it her cousin who's such a horrible person?
Oh, no, it's her sister-in-law.
Her sister-in-law.
Yeah,
okay.
her brother Binky, who's the current Duke, right. is married to someone called Fig, who is absolutely awful. And I'm afraid I stole the nickname. My husband's family has aristocratic background,
uh-huh.
and he does have cousins with nicknames like that. And one of them is called Fig, so I stole her name.
So are these the names they get in school? Is that where they come from?
Sometimes it's school, sometimes it's home. You know, it's... you know, if someone's very small, he might get called Shrimpy, you know. And I suppose because they have such very long and ponderous names, you know,
right.
like Sebastian and those sort of names, that you tend to get a nickname in the nursery, or if not, then at school. And the nicknames at school are often really cruel.
Right. Tell me about the hyphenated last names. Is that just because two families want to keep their name?
I actually have one. My married name isn't actually a hyphenated name.
Okay.
The true ones come when two large properties are joined together. So two families with property marry,
uh-huh.
and the wife has enough importance that she gets to keep her name. In the case of my own family, the wife, this goes back to the mid-1800s, the wife was from the family of the Earl of Dunraven,
mm-hmm.
and so she got to keep her part of the name.
Uh-huh.
These days, of course, it's fashionable just to, especially if your name is Jones or Smith, then you link something else like Smith Fortescue or something to
right. Well, in Wales, Jones is what the most common last name is.
Oh, everybody's called
isn't it?
Jones, yeah, absolutely. It means son of John, you know.
Well,
Yeah.
That's right. Okay, so where do we want to go from here? They're on dry land, and then they decide they need to continue their honeymoon in a different locale.
Well, Georgie would like to, but, you know, they're both pretty much broke. They've
right.
never had any money. And Darcy has promised her a wonderful honeymoon, but they get back to the house that she's been sort of inheriting, a very lovely house in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And her mother's there and her grandfather's there and the owner of the house is there. And she thinks to herself, okay, this is all very nice, but is this it? Am I now back to real life already?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so she tries to be brave about it, thinking, what a lovely life I have. I'm with Darcy and I'm in this nice house. What could be better? But there's a slight nagging doubt at the back about, well, I thought we were going to go somewhere on our honeymoon.
Right. Something special.
Yeah. So the one thing they do have to look forward to is that they've been invited to a royal garden party. The Queen, who's Queen Mary at the time, of course,
mm-hmm.
is very fond of Georgie. And Georgie has had to renounce her place in the line of succession to marry Darcy because he's a Catholic. In those days, nobody in the royal family was allowed to marry a Catholic. And do you know when that was repealed?
Quite recently.
2 years ago.
Yes.
That's rather an amazing thing.
Let's take that as a segue into the time and place this is. It's 1935 in England. All of Ireland is still part of England. England
no,
has
no. 1920
they
moved
into
across.
Two? Okay.
Yeah, yes,
and they still have many colonies around the world.
They do, yeah.
One of which, of course, several of which are in Africa.
Yeah,
and we're going to go visit Kenya quickly. But what else is happening in England at the time? That's so because there's little references through the book, you know, like what's going on in Germany and what's going on in France, et cetera, et cetera.
England is still pretty much in the Great Depression. They've come out of the worst of it, but there's no real light at the end of the tunnel.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you have is this huge contrast between the haves and the have-nots.
Right.
There are some families that have managed to cling on to their wealth, possibly because they've got properties in various parts of the world and things. And so you have, as you know, from a Woodhouse, you have Bertie Wooster, who
right.
is drinking champagne from a slipper and driving around knocking off policemen's helmets. And at the same time, you have men standing in a bread line wearing their war medals from the Great War,
mm-hmm.
holding up signs saying, we'll accept any kind of work. You have this enormous divide. You also have, throughout the world, and also in England, you have this knife-edge struggle between communism and fascism.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, being Britain, you know, if you'd lived in another country, like Spain has gone to fascism, Germany is going to fascism, the British are so sensible. They're right down the middle of the road. They don't want anything too extreme. So even though you have Oswald Mosley, who is a fascist, who's walking around with his black shirts, and you have people who are communists,
yes,
there are not many of them. And the average person says, how silly, and wants to just have their pint at the pub and get on with life. But we do have, and it comes out in the books, you can gradually see, if you read the whole series, the rise of fascism in Germany, mm-hmm. which I think is going to play a big part in the future books,
mm-hmm.
especially because Georgie's mother is living with a German industrialist who has stopped making as many automobiles and maybe moving to making weapons of war.
Right.
And
well,
so
Georgie's mother is a fascinating character. I imagine you either, probably many people think she's the most exciting of all of the ones you've created.
She's an interesting person because she came from nothing. She came from a very poor family, became a famous, incredibly beautiful, became a famous actress, married Georgie's father, so she became a duchess.
Mm-hmm.
And then she was a bolter, just like the Idina Sackville in the current novel. She ran away from Georgie's father when Georgie was two.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said in one of the books, she's been a great many things to many men on six of the seven continents, Antarctica being too cold to do much.
Right. You don't want to go outside in the cold. I'll just be what is it, the line? I may be some time. Yes.
Oh, yeah.
But that's the mother who has been the role model for Georgina.
Well, she hasn't seen that much of her because, as I said, the mother bolted and she's lived with an Argentinian polo player and a French racing driver.
Mm-hmm.
And she's currently with Max von Stroheim, who seems nice enough, except he speaks very little English and she speaks no German. So I don't know. They don't communicate very much, but she seems quite happy with him.
Mm-hmm.
Until things have started to go wrong. His father's died and he's inherited this vast industrial empire. And his mother is a Lutheran and does not approve of Georgie's mother's lifestyle.
Right.
Georgie's mother is the most self-centered person in the world. She only appears for Georgie when she wants something.
Uh-huh.
So Georgie has learned you cannot rely on her. Luckily, she has a grandfather who she can rely on, who's the mother's father.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a lovely person. And when I asked the other day on my Facebook page, who's your favorite character in the series apart from Georgie, Granddad won.
Interesting.
So, you know, they like the
reliability.
They like the
positive reliability.
Yeah, the reliability of him, yes.
Yeah. So where did this idea come to you? So this is the 12th book in the series, is it?
Well, the Cheetahs
the
is the
Cheetahs.
13th.
13th.
It's the 13th
book.
Now, yes.
Okay, lucky 13.
Lucky 13, yes.
And you must, and as I've read, you'd been writing other books, other mystery novels.
Yes.
Different series.
Yeah.
And then did she just appear, you know, whole cloth, or did she a combination of people you knew, or what?
Well, what happened was I was writing the Molly Murphy series, and I continued with that. I've just put her on hold for a while, but we're up to book 17 in that series.
Mm-hmm.
And my publisher said to me, we can't really break you out unless you write us a big, dark, standalone novel. So I went away, and I thought, oh, okay. Serial killers, child molesters, terrorists poisoning the water supply.
Mm.
And then I'd turn on television and I just thought, wait, do I really want to spend 6 months with these people? And I thought, it's not me.
Yeah.
I'm not dark by nature. In fact, I'd once said all of my reviews when Constable Evans first came out said, this charming series, this delightful and charming. And I wanted to be taken seriously, so I said to my editor, in my next book I'm going to have cannibalism, Satanism, and strewn body parts.
Uh-huh.
And she said, and I bet they're going to be charming and delightful body parts too.
So, well, this is you like to write what's called cozies of
yeah,
the genre.
I mean, yeah. I hate the word cozies because it's belittling. I like to write.
Well, it's Agatha Christie's the start of this,
I would
right?
call it more the traditional mystery.
Right.
You know, it's mainly the amateur sleuth. There is very little on-stage violence. Obviously, there's as much evil in this sort of book as there is in a very noir book, but it's not shown. And there's usually a satisfying ending.
Mm-hmm.
And they're usually within a situation where you have maybe a small town or a house or something where the people who do the killing know each other.
Right.
So that's the essential background.
Right.
And that's what I like writing. And I think it's in a way it's more important, because if you write a noir book and you've got someone who's a drug dealer who's stabbed in the back streets of the city, you're expecting badness to happen. You're expecting a chaotic universe. But if you have a suburban street like mine,
mm-hmm.
and my next door neighbor murders, suddenly you've disrupted the whole fabric of that society, and it's up to the sleuth to put it back together again. In the noir novel, it's never put back together again. It's always a chaotic society. So I think, you know, it depends. If your outlook on life is optimistic, you probably write cozies. And if your outlook on life is essentially pessimistic, you go to something darker. And I guess I must be a happy person, and I like my books to end satisfactorily. They don't all end happily, but they end with judgment being served in some way and people having their lives in some way put back in order. And that's
and
what
the
I
people
like
to, who've yeah. been spotting the clues yeah. and the red herrings feel yeah. comfortable
yeah,
because they had almost got there if they hadn't
yeah,
figured
yeah.
it out. Yes.
Yeah. And so when I thought about writing this big, dark standalone, I realized it wasn't me.
Right.
So I thought, what would be the most unlikely sleuth I could think of? And I thought, well, how about if she was royal? That's fun. She's royal, but she's penniless. And then I thought, well, it has to be in the 1930s, because what a fascinating time that is. It's poised between two world wars.
Mm-hmm.
You've got a Great Depression. You've got, as I said before, some people who still drink champagne out of slippers and go to their yachts on the Med, and other people who are standing in a line for soup.
Mm-hmm.
You've got this incredible divergence. And life is not... You had World War I, and you would have thought that would change society forever. And it really didn't. If you watch Downton Abbey...
Well, in many ways, though, it did. When we were visiting, we happened to be in a... went to a windmill.
Yes.
The man looked out over the, you know, the fields around him and started reminiscing about World War One.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, the best and the brightest, we lost an entire generation.
We did,
a million
yeah.
people.
Yeah. Well,
yeah.
Yeah. I mean, your chances of marriage, if you were a young woman at the right age after World War One, were 1 in 10.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you've seen it, but this year I wrote a book called The Victory Garden,
which is
about World War One, which is about home life in World War One,
mm-hmm.
and what happens if a whole generation of young men is not coming back. Who is going to be the blacksmith? Who is
mm-hmm.
going to be the butcher?
Mm-hmm.
And women are called upon to do things that they didn't think they were physically capable of. And they have to bond together to do these things. That's what the whole book's about.
Right.
So, you know, I'm very aware of that. So you had World War One, and you'd think it would have changed society completely. But then you look at Downton Abbey, and we're in the 1920s in Downton Abbey.
Mm-hmm.
After the war,
mm-hmm.
they still have all their servants. They still live the same life.
Yeah, it's impacted. Remember, there's the market crash, and he gets the letter.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I mean, luckily, conveniently, according to that plot, which is very, to me, problematic, Matthew just happens to inherit a fortune at the time when there's a great crash. There's
right.
A lot of things.
Well, Julian doesn't want it. The
no, Julian.
Rock
Julian.
Too much,
no,
right.
he, Julian is a naughty boy when he writes that plot, I have to say. But anyway, it couldn't have gone on if they had to sell Downton Abbey after episode 14. It wouldn't.
And
have...
and that's what many people had to do to
yeah.
because there was no cash coming in
you
because
to,
there was
yeah.
no one working on the land, et cetera, yeah, et cetera, yeah. et cetera.
Well, that was one of the big things. This book that I wrote called The Victory Garden is
yes.
the women have to go and work on the land
right.
because everybody's going to starve otherwise. So it's interesting. But the 1930 census, the biggest occupational category was still domestic servant.
Really?
Which is amazing, isn't
wow.
it?
Wow.
Yeah.
And they weren't paid anything at all. They weren't setting money aside for retirement or
no,
any of that
no.
kind of stuff.
I mean, they were paid a small salary, but most of it they would send home to their families because obviously they were living, their board and clothing
mm-hmm.
and everything was provided. And if you had a good household, like Downton Abbey, it was quite a good life because
mm-hmm.
if you were in the kitchen, you didn't have to do the laundry. And if you were sweeping the floors, you didn't have to cook. So if you weren't worked too hard, it was quite a satisfying life in that you were very secure. You weren't going to lose your job.
Right.
But it took World War II. When people came back after World War II and said, I'm not going to go back into that again. And then finally, the cost of things like coal to heat a house
mm-hmm.
and things like that rose enough so that the big houses finally got sold. Often they got pulled down and an estate put on, you know, a housing estate put on there. Now, I was up in Yorkshire with a friend once, and I was looking in an estate agent window, and they had this beautiful gentleman's residence with 10 reception rooms and God knows how many bedrooms and lots of land. And I looked at the price, and I live in Marin County, and
right.
I said, I could completely afford this.
Mm-hmm.
And my friend said, ah, but could you afford to heat it?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the problem.
Many still using fireplaces for heat.
Yeah. Yes. Oh, yeah. Well, that's another thing with Downton Abbey. You see those lovely dresses. I've been in houses like that. I grew up in a big house. You're cold all the time because, you know, the fireplace is at one end of a 40-foot room and you're sitting at the other end. And it, you wouldn't go around in a backless dress. You'd have a wrap over it, really.
Right. Well, you know, it's television.
It's television, yeah.
You know, because you were in it.
Yeah.
So when you were working on scripts for the BBC and Australian Broadcasting,
yeah.
did it train you to do things in a different way? Do you think in a cinematic way?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. When I'm writing, I don't ever work in terms of chapters. I work in terms of scenes.
Ah.
Yeah. Where do we come in on our characters? Where do we find them? And how do we get them out of this scene? When do we cut and go somewhere else? That's really how I think I see everything very visually. And I don't outline, which is one of the things that shocks a lot of people, especially when I teach a writing course.
Right.
And I say to my students, you know, I don't ever outline. I see these looks of panic on their faces. And but for me, it doesn't work. If I outlined, I'd be bored by the time I started to write the real book.
Really?
Yeah. And also, I wouldn't have give my characters the freedom to go off where they want to. And they do quite often.
By saying that, you don't mean in the book. You mean they just take off on themselves because they become entities.
I'm writing this scene and I've got a dialogue and then one of the characters says something and I look down and I think, oh, why did you say that? That's very strange.
Mm.
And then I follow them and we go somewhere different. And I have to be available to do that. So I say I'm writing scenes. I like to think I'm standing behind the curtains and I'm watching my characters, whatever they're going to do. And I'm following them. And if they go out of the door, I follow them out of the door.
Right.
And I think also dialogue has become very important to me because dialogue is a wonderful vehicle for giving you a sense of place, giving you a sense of time, giving you a sense of how the characters see each other in terms of society and in rank,
mm-hmm.
and also moving the plot forward. You move the plot forward so much better in, you know, and then she looked around and ran out of the door and,
right.
you know,
right.
instead of saying, oh, my God, I've got to go.
Yes. Well, it's a dialogue-driven novel.
Yes, yes.
It also reads very much like a screenplay as
yes,
I look at
yeah.
it.
And are you listening, BBC?
Yes,
screenplay. Hint, hint.
Well, I know, because you would think that this would be perfect. The amount of interest in the royals in Britain and in this country
is just
tremendous.
I know. I mean, I've had options on a lot of my other work.
Mm-hmm.
They bought the first book in this series to make what they called at the time a major motion picture. It never materialized. They did pay me for it. But
that's good.
We went through about four different screenwriters, and it never materialized.
Right.
But I think it would be much better as like BBC type.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a Miss Fisher type thing,
yes.
because it's fun.
Or even and, Australian broadcast.
Oh, yeah, ABC. What yeah,
they've
they
got some
yeah.
wonderful
yeah.
productions.
Yeah, oh, they do, yeah.
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 Oh, well. we will root for that right
yeah,
here
we
on
will.
The air.
Yes, we will. Thank you. yeah.
So we have the honeymoon's going on. They're a few days into it. They get out, and I can't remember where they're standing when the groom announces that they're going to go to a...
Yeah, they're at the Royal Garden Party.
They're at the Royal Garden Party.
Yeah, because they go to the Royal Garden Party and the King and Queen stop and talk to them.
Mm-hmm.
And as usual, Georgie is a little... She's a little naive. She's also a little clumsy in moments of stress. Things happen to her.
Mm-hmm.
You know, things throughout the books have become a little uncomfortable. And before the King and Queen arrive, she's just bitten into a volleyball.
Yes.
And it was a very sort of... dry volleyball with not very much filling,
mm-hmm.
and she made her cough, and she sort of inhaled some crumbs, and she's also spluttered some crumbs down her navy front.
Which is not her dress.
No, she's borrowed the dress from a Polish princess, yes. So she's...
because everybody knows
everybody
one
does
of those,
that,
right?
Yes, of course. So she then realizes that if she opens her mouth, she may cough again, and she may splutter out some more So she's swallowing hard when the king and queen arrive. So she lets Darcy do the talking. And the king says, oh, you know, so you're back from your honeymoon, are you? And Darcy says, well, we're just about to set off again. And the queen says, really, where are you going? And he says, we're going to Kenya. Well, Georgie's trying very hard not to cough at this because she's never heard of this before. And she wonders if Darcy's just saying that to be important to the king and queen, you know, to say something. So the moment the king and queen have gone, she leaps and says, are we really going to Kenya? And he says, yes, we are. I didn't want to tell you about it before because it wasn't all arranged, but we're going next Tuesday. So that's how she finds out.
Let's take that as a perfect example of a scene. Did that just jump out at you? What prompted it? Do you remember?
Well, I wanted them to be at the Royal Garden Party because one of the reasons is that I love doing something that annoys her sister-in-law.
Now, the other thing is that just think of the TV version or whatever, how gorgeous it's going to look.
Oh, yeah, we can borrow the back of Buckingham Palace. I'm sure they won't mind. it's lovely grounds there, actually, at the back. It's very nice. So her sister-in-law, Fig, always feels annoyed that the Queen invites Georgie to things and she's not invited. So when Georgie and Darcy meet them, she says, well, we've been invited to the Royal Garden Party, she says. I guess the King and Queen finally admit that we're close relatives. And what a shame you're not in the line of succession anymore.
Right.
But then an invitation also arrives for Georgie. And on her invitation is a little handwritten note from the Queen saying, we do hope that you can come. We so look forward to seeing you. So poor old Fig, she can never get the better of Georgie.
No.
So they're all at the Royal Garden Party. And I hadn't really intended that that would be when. But, you know, Darcy talks and I have to follow what he says. And he announced it then. So then we find we're going to Kenya.
Right. And you made her unable to speak at the time so that it would all work.
It would all work, thanks to the vol-au-vent.
That's right. That's right. So going to Kenya is a trek. I was delighted to read about how they got there because we all think of, you know, going, I don't know, in boats or up the Nile or something. Yeah. I guess, you really can't get to Kenya up the Nile because there was
to go through the Suez Canal.
Yes, the Suez Canal.
And then down through the Red Sea.
Right, right. Yeah. But they go by airplane, or at least for a large part of the trip, which was something quite new. And not only is it an airplane, it is a seaplane.
Some of it, yes.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing about this is it's all completely authentic.
Mm-hmm.
My father-in-law was one of the founders and heads of Imperial Airways.
Oh.
So he was on that first flight down from London to Cape Town.
Is that what became BOAC?
It became BOAC, yes. Yeah, he started off with Daimler Airways in 1922.
Oh, yeah.
And then Daimler
Airways made the engines.
Daimler and Hanley Page and Three amalgamated to make Imperial Airways, and that became BOAC.
Well, how neat.
So we have his letters that he sent home from each part of the trek down through Africa. And in reality, I have to confess, this is fiction. In reality, it took 9 days to get to Kenya. But I didn't want to, you know, I thought 9 days on a plane with Mrs. Simpson might be a little too much for everybody.
Right,
so I had
to
speed it up. So I made my ground crew much more efficient to get them off, loaded up and off again very quickly. So it only takes 5 days in my book. But what you'd do is you'd fly to, well, there were various ways. You could fly to Marseille and then fly across by flying boat.
Mm-hmm.
Or you could fly to Basel in Switzerland.
Right.
And then what they do is go by train through the Alps, which a lot of people did because the Alps were notoriously bumpy and people got seasick airsick all the time. So Darcy, thinking about Georgie, his new bride, decides they'll go by train through the Alps and then they pick up the flying boat in Brindisi, go across to Alexandria, and from there, Cairo, Khartoum, Juba, and then end up in Kimusu. So,
well, of course, we don't know how he pays for this.
We don't know.
It's never quite clear.
No.
But we assume that he's something or other in something or other that has a big, deep pockets.
Yes. Darcy has accepted throughout the books various assignments, which he can never tell her about. So we have to think that he does something for the British government, or perhaps he accepts commissions from other people, maybe more shady.
Right.
He tends to go and come without telling her where he's going. And this time, obviously, someone else is paying for the trip, which she...
Because it would have been quite expensive to go that
It would have
way.
Been very expensive, yes. Yeah, because the planes, those planes, they could carry 40 people. And the Hannibal was fitted out for 24. So.
And what I liked is the description of how when you're flying the, you know, the waiter, I guess we'll call him.
The steward, he was called.
The steward is, you know, bringing you trays of food and drink and stuff.
Yeah. Well, and yes, and you, in on this Hannibal, I've seen the pictures of the interior. It was like a luxurious train carriage. Mm. You had your own little sort of compartment area and with sort of nice velvet hangings and things. And he would put, you know, you'd have the white tablecloth and everything. I have to tell you, in the early days when I was flying, my husband was with an airline and we did fly first class all the time. Mm-hmm. In those days, you got a white tablecloth and china and everything else. So I've done
and
that,
the lounge
too.
Upstairs in the big place. That,
yes, you went and stood up by the bar. That was
right,
very nice.
If you're going
yeah.
to Australia, it was a long trip.
Yeah.
There may not be tigers or bears on today's Word by Word, but there are lots of hungry lions, charging elephants, ravenous army ants, and both animal and human kinds of cheetahs. Since our guest is the New York Times multiple bestseller and winner of over 20 writing awards, Rhys Bowen, with her latest mystery novel, Life and Death Among the Cheetahs. So stay tuned to Word by Word, conversations with writers from Northern California Public Media, KRCB-FM, for another half hour of a Royal Spinus investigation in colonial Kenya. Okay, so we're back. We've gotten there. We've flown on the plane. There are certain people, characters who were introduced to us who are on the plane flight as well, and they're all going to be important. I guess we'll call them suspects, because we know there's a murder because it's in the title of your book, right?
Yeah.
So Wallace Simpson is there, and she is the, talked about in the tabloids, kind of best close friend to the Duke of Wales. Is that what he's called, Duke of Wales?
The Prince of Wales. Prince of Wales.
And she's an American heiress who is in the process of divorcing her something or other number husband. And it's quite a bit of talk back home in England.
There was not much talk because Lord Beaverbrook, who was the head of the main newspapers, kept it suppressed.
Ah.
I mean, it might have mentioned, you know, there might have been a picture of a friend of the Prince of Wales.
Well, but Georgina knows about who she is.
Among upper-class circles, everybody knows who she is. But the average person on the street was quite shocked when they learned that he wanted to marry her because it had been suppressed until then. But in upper-class circles, obviously he goes everywhere with her. She's at his side all the time. So everybody who's upper-class knows who she is.
Right. He's got a bit of a philanderer himself.
He's
to be polite.
He's lived a very
dissolute
life. Yes. I mean, I think the interesting thing is that the middle class in England was so moral.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you only held hands till you got married, and the upper class really slept around all the time. And most people, if you go back to King Edward VII. He had a whole string of mistresses. Mm-hmm. And then this current prince, you know, the Prince of Wales in my story, who becomes the Duke of Windsor later, he had a whole string of mistresses. And they all used to have these parties where they drank a lot, where cocaine was passed around. And the funny thing was that some of these people, including one of the characters in my book, Edina Sackville, they married all the time. Why did they bother to marry? I suppose it was for money each time, but... They married and got divorced 2 years later and then ran off with someone else.
Right.
What a waste of time, all those wedding ceremonies.
Well, I know, but they made more money each time, didn't they?
Well,
I mean, you were telling me about how people kept their hyphenated names so that they could, not because of the people, but because of the properties.
Because two families joined together, equally valuable. Yeah.
Now, the other thing that's going on that probably our listeners need to know is what is happening in Kenya. And you have to kind of go back to, I had a farm in Africa, you know, with Isaac Dinesen.
Yeah.
And that was what you did, is Kenya was, if you got to the right altitude, was, you know, a place to live and you could raise coffee or cattle or whatever and have them be taken care of by the natives who were treated abominably, to be polite.
Yeah.
And one of the things you apologize in before we get into your book about how the language that's used around the servants.
Yeah.
And how demeaning it is.
Well, the whole thing with every British colony is that and every European colony, I'm sure, is that the Europeans think that they are bringing civilization, culture, and a better standard of living to
Christianity.
Yeah, to the poor, innocent, ignorant natives. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, this is true. I mean, you take India, for example. Railways joined the whole of India. They brought hospitals. They brought schools. They lessened disease. They stopped warring between the various states. But at the same time, they saw themselves as the standard, and they saw themselves as the conqueror, too. Mm-hmm. And in Africa, they talked about the natives as if they were children.
Mm-hmm.
If they were nice people, if they were kind people, it was sort of a patronizing way. But if they weren't, then they were quite abusive to their workers. Mm-hmm. And they used all of their house servants were male. They didn't use female house servants at all. And they would dress them with a white suit and white gloves and have them stand behind the table serving.
Maybe even a fez.
Yeah, an fez, yeah. Quite often. And they called them boy. One thing that one didn't know was that in the Kikuyu culture, of course, in the Maasai would not be house. They refused to be house servants. You did not tame the Maasai. But the Kikuyu, the Somalis, the other tribes that they used, in those cultures, a man did no housework. And to make him a house servant was really the ultimate demeaning and emasculating thing you could do.
Mm-hmm.
So, but then they had to take the jobs, because when you have people coming in, and you, in the past you've lived entirely on barter, you grow corn and he grows this and we swap some.
Right.
Now money becomes a factor.
A cash economy.
So if they don't work for the British, they can't feed their families. So you've changed the whole complex of society. And you can understand that the seething resentment, which really boils over in the 1950s when you have the Mau Mau rebellions, mm-hmm. and they slaughter a whole lot of colonists.
With good reason.
Yeah.
Yeah. The interesting thing, of course, as we go through the book, we discover more about the people who are being servants. We have one who is a Maasai.
Yes.
Who has done as you do when you come of age, you know, confronted a lion and
yes.
killed him and wears
yes.
The cloak, yeah. you know, the lion skin is a cloak.
Yeah. Yes.
Which was, as you said, was extremely unusual. And
yes. Well, he was taken, I'm not going to give away any of the
plot. No, I don't want to go through that.
But he was taken under the tutelage of one of the characters called Lord Sheraton,
mm-hmm.
When he was all his life. He's been
right.
He's been British educated. So he's one of these people who spans two worlds. As Georgie herself does, really.
Well, actually, three yeah. worlds when you think
yeah,
of it.
Yeah, yes.
He's got his native village world.
Yeah,
he's
yeah.
got his world where he's
yeah.
the servant.
Yeah.
And then he's got the, you know, what he was when he was in England, the
yeah.
student life,
yeah.
too.
Yes. So he's not really one thing or the other anymore,
right.
which I think Georgie can appreciate because that's happened to her.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's been raised in this almost royal situation. But she has a grandfather who lives in a little house in Essex and keeps
right.
gnomes in his front garden. So,
exactly.
you know, she can see a bit of both. It makes you a very good observer if you're an outsider, too.
Okay, so we've heard about a few of the characters. Everybody seems to go visit people because there's a, I guess we'll call it an enclave of
yeah.
British in this part of the
yeah.
country. And they're not that far away. I don't know, maybe they have. You know,
yeah.
a couple hundred acres or something.
Yeah. yeah.
So they drive from place to place, and they spend the night, and they dress for dinner, and they.
Yeah.
Servants serve food that, with the fact of, except for the meat, mm-hmm. could have been served in England.
Yes.
It's a different, you know, wild.
It's interesting because they do live completely to the standards of the British,
mm-hmm.
even though they're far away. I should explain that they're in a place called the Happy Valley, which was a high valley in the Aberdare Mountains.
Real place.
Yeah, a real place. And in those days was very heavily forested so that an elephant could step out in front of your car all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you went there, you wouldn't recognize it because it's been denuded by logging and also by firewood gathering
mm-hmm.
and also by small holdings. So it's a very different scene if you went there these days. So they live there in this very rarefied atmosphere.
Both ways, because they're up high.
They're up high.
So it's not too 8,
8,
hot.
8,000 feet.
Yes.
And also they're away from, the judgment of the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, they live this European English lifestyle in that they dress for dinner, they have cocktails, you know, they behave in a very British manner. But then all the rules of civilization with regard to what's considered acceptable behavior have gone. So, you know, wife swapping is a quite normal pastime,
mm-hmm.
and cocaine is passed around a lot, and they drink like fishes. When she goes to a polo match, they're drinking at 9 a.m, and it's considered quite normal there.
She did quite well on the back of the polo pony, didn't
yeah,
she?
Yeah, by luck, you know. the polo pony knew what it was doing more
That's
than
right.
she did. Yeah.
That's right.
Now she's terrified she's going to hit the hammer at the wrong time and knock off the Prince of Wales and kill the heir, you know.
Yes. Oh, well, she makes it through. Yes, she does. She grits her teeth and goes forward. I'm trying to think of what to talk about in Africa without giving away too much of the plot. Can we talk about what they discover on the road just before the rock formation? Is that fair?
Well, we can say that one of the obviously it's going to be a mystery because these all are. Georgie has a propensity for stumbling upon dead bodies. So they stumble upon a car parked in the middle of the road.
Right.
And it's empty.
A Buick.
A Buick, yeah. Yeah, someone asked me, why Buicks? And I said, well, they were very sturdy cars, and the roads, you were apt to break axles very easily. So they were quite popular at that time.
Mm-hmm.
The car is empty, and the engine's still running.
Right.
And so this is quite, they think maybe he's just gone into the bushes to the call of nature.
Right.
And then, of course, they discover a dead body with vultures all over it. And they think he's been attacked by a lion.
Mm-hmm. They find a tuft of lion hair.
They find a tuft of lion hair on a bush, yes.
Gives them a clue.
Yeah.
There is, however, she's very observant, as is her husband. They notice there's only one set of tire tracks.
Yeah.
And they think they figured that out, although a little bit later, not to give away too much. There are more than one Buick in the vicinity.
There is, yeah.
Yeah, and they all have the same tires.
Yeah.
So they turn around, go back to the house where they've been staying, and announce what happens. They have, and what happens then is interesting because people don't want to call the police. They want to leave, you know, the other guests.
Yes.
And because they don't want to have people know they were at this house party with all of it swinging going on.
Now, we should mention this house party.
Okay, let's do that.
Because Georgie is one of the most naive people you've ever come across. Mm-hmm. You know, she's grown up in fairly secluded Scotland, in a castle in Scotland.
And cold there.
Oh, it's very cold, yes. And so she really hasn't, she's not a society person at all. She hasn't had that much experience mixing in high society. And so for her to go to a party like this, it's a real character, this Lady Adina Sackville, who hosts these parties. She was a real person, and the things that happen at her party really did happen at her parties. You know, I do a lot of my research by reading people's autobiographies and things, and so
of which there's a list in the end of your
so
book.
Anything that happens pretty much happened in a real place in a real time. And the first thing, when Georgie is shown into their bedroom, this is where you're going to spend the night, she looks up and there's a mirror on the ceiling. And she says, well, how very silly. Why would you put a mirror up there? You can't even see to do your hair properly.
Mm-hmm.
And when Darcy explains to her, she knows, she's, oh, golly, you know, she's absolutely, absolutely astounded. So Darcy keeps a close eye on her and really wishes they hadn't come, but was no way really to get out of it because, you know, they'd accepted this invitation.
Right.
But there's a lot of naughty things going to start happening, including they play a game called the Feathers Game, where you sit around a table and you blow a feather around, and the person it lands on is the person you're going to spend the night with.
Mm-hmm.
So Darcy whisks Georgie away from this, and that's why they leave the party so early and why they stumble upon this car.
Well, what they didn't understand, I think both of them didn't understand this, is by accepting the invitation for the evening, other people made the assumption that they were there to trade partners.
Yes, of course, yeah.
And this one man who ends up, they find dead, had, you know, staked out Georgina as his next prey.
He does, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And other women were looking at Darcy with, you know, covetous looks.
Yeah, yes.
So they're kind of the fish out of water, to put it politely,
oh, absolutely,
in there.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they try and explain, look, we're on our honeymoon. We're not interested.
Right, right.
And that's a fairly good excuse, I think.
And I think they come up with the old headache excuse. Yes. So, but anyway, they managed to survive, at least that. And that's why they're leaving early in the morning and why they discover the body, because they're the first ones away from the house. Because everybody else, when they get back, this is what we're talking about. Nobody wants to have it public knowledge that they've been there, because the whole country probably knows what's going on.
Yeah, and especially one of them who has come from Nairobi, which is quite a long drive, and he is a government official, and he certainly, that would jeopardize his chances for future promotion to know that he was at this party. And it turns out that his wife was the one who was very keen, because she assumed the Prince of Wales would be there. And because when the Prince of Wales had been there several years before, she'd been one of the people who'd had a little fling with him.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Royal blood.
As had most of the women, I expected.
Exactly. So we got all kinds of levels of intrigue going on in this murder mystery, which makes it, it's a time and a place that's, I think, unique. I guess you might be able to write about the, you know, the 60s in San Francisco with similar kinds of thoughts, but without the money. It's an insular place, as were, you know, other enclaves of Britishisms and other countries who had, you know, colonies around the world, because the people who would go to these would be escaping something at home, often, if they're not posted there as part of the...
Yeah, if you have to ask yourself, why would somebody go out to a remote part of Africa?
Right.
It was not usually to make money, because I don't think the people there made that much money. If you look at Out of Africa, you know, she had
after the fire, they have nothing.
They have nothing, yes. Yeah. So, you know, it's often a second son who's not going to inherit the property at home. Mm-hmm. It's someone who has somehow blotted his copybook and his family sends him far away.
Right.
It's always the people you want to get rid of who go out to Africa, except for a few types who are really adventurous and who look forward to the huge challenge of being out in the bush and creating a farm from the virgin bush. There are a few of those, too. Mm-hmm. If you read Elspeth Huxley's...
Right.
Her family want to do that.
I've read that.
Flame Trees of Thika, yeah, and so you know, her family wanted to make something out of nothing. That huge, that adventurous British spirit that sent people around the world. You had a few of those as well.
Didn't know what they were doing.
No,
but they.
I mean, they were aristocrats,
right.
You know, and they had no clue at all. But and some of them succeeded well. Some of them obviously failed miserably.
Well, that's the story here about the one who's most successful, I guess, the man who ends up dead. He's developed his farm because he's relied on the locals, the natives, to provide him information on how to raise the crops and do the things.
Yeah, well, especially the breeding of the cattle.
I mean,
the Maasai are absolute experts with cattle, and he's taken the trouble to listen to them and interbreed with their local local cattle, so he's doing very well.
So they, when they're bitten by the tsetse flies, wasn't it?
Yeah.
They don't, you know, come down with the disease.
No.
Yeah. Astounding. Yeah. Wonderful, wonderful place to set this thing.
Oh, well, I mean, you could go on forever, couldn't you?
You could.
You've got the drama of the soldier ants and the
elephants. I expected them to play a larger role than there they are.
Well, we could have had a bad person who was devoured by them at the end, but we didn't.
That was some B-movies I saw as a kid, as I recall.
Yeah, I mean, I should also add that this is based on a true murder. That's one of the intriguing things about writing this book, was there was a character called Lord Errol who was one of the leaders of this society. And a few years after this, or around this time, he was found sitting in his car, slumped over the steering wheel, having been shot at close range. And they never found out who did it.
No.
Probably because, like in my book, they want to keep it to themselves.
Unsolved mystery.
Yeah. And so, you know, every woman in the colony had been his mistress.
Right.
And so you had a lot of disgruntled husbands. You had a former mistress who had shown herself to be mentally unstable, who had shot one of her former husbands. So, but all these people seemed to have an alibi.
Mm.
And they did arrest the husband of the current mistress, but they had to let him go because there was no evidence at all. And so that's a murder that's still unsolved.
I
thought I'd better write a murder that I can solve nicely
by
the end. Yes,
that's right. And you do.
I do. Yes.
I won't give that away. One of the other things that's happening is the same character who has been murdered, in addition to having all this, you know, stealing men's wives, and their property and demeaning them publicly in the newspaper, et cetera,
yes,
et cetera, because
yes.
there's a lawsuit that
not
ruins
a really nice
one.
Person,
not
no.
a nice
no,
person
no.
at all. He's also just been elected to the colonial parliament or whatever
Assembly,
it's called.
Yeah.
And he's a great fan of Adolf Hitler.
He is. He's you know, there were in England quite a few aristocrats who were huge fans of Adolf Hitler.
Right.
In another book that I wrote called In Farley Field, the whole story is about a secret ring of aristocrats who was trying to help the invasion.
Mm-hmm.
They think, well, in their case, they wanted to spare Britain from more bombing.
Right.
And they believed that Germany and England have so much in common that we would get along splendidly if Hitler came in. It was a completely naive view. But this man, yes, is a huge fan, and there are other people around him also who are all fans of Nazism and Hitler.
You made reference to a politician several times, a British politician, who was basically a fascist.
Mm-hmm.
And his name is?
Oswald Mosley?
Yes.
Yeah, he ran the black shirts.
Yes.
He had this group who imitated the German brown shirts who went around raising their hands and Heil Hitlering and things, you know.
Yeah.
He was an extremist, but he was a dangerous one because he did attract people.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Are you doing another Georgina book, or are you doing something standalone?
Well,
or?
I do two books a year at the moment, which
two
is quite ridiculous.
Okay,
yeah,
let's see. Do you do work on one and finish it, or
yeah.
do you work both?
Oh, no, I have to work on one and finish it, okay. And then I go straight to the other one. So I have just finished. The first half of the year was writing a book, a standalone, about Queen Victoria in Nice. And that's a little departure for me, going further back in time and, you know, writing about Queen Victoria.
I remember her going to Nice in the Victoria TV show.
Well, yeah, the end years of her life.
Ah.
She spent her entire winter in Nice.
Ah.
Or on the Riviera. She tried Monton first.
I thought she had a friend who was a Scottish.
Well, that was after he died.
Oh,
yeah, he'd died already by then. This is when the book I'm writing about, she's 77, so it's the last 4 years of her life. And so she went to Nice, and they built this enormous hotel for her. And the fun thing was that she went to this with all of her entourage. She took all of her servants, all of her cooks, all of her bedroom furniture on a special train.
Which were specially made for her, as I remember. Yes.
Yeah, on a special train and a regiment of pipers. And then she said, "I don't want anybody to know I'm the queen." Now, is that not a giveaway that every time you go out, there's a regiment of pipers who walks ahead of you? She said, "I want to be known as Lady Balmoral."
Lady Balmoral.
So the book I've written, she's not the main character. She features in it quite prominently because it's about several plots.
Mm-hmm.
But my main character is a young woman who becomes her chef, one of the first female chefs.
Really?
So it's going to be called Above the Bay of Angels, and that comes out next February.
Fun. Well, I'll look forward to that.
And I've just started writing the next Georgie book, and I thought after all the excitement of Kenya, she needs to be closer to home. And she needs to be in a more secure environment. So I've sent her down to Cornwall. And the one thing I wanted to do, which I'm doing, which is a homage to Rebecca, you know, the brooding country house.
Oh, the Rebecca. The
Daphne du Maurier's Rebecca.
The movie and
Hitchcock's. So the brooding country house and the very creepy housekeeper and a secret of the house
creepy
that nobody wants known.
Yes.
So isn't that fun?
Oh, yes.
Having lots of fun with that because
I'm
bringing
in a gothic.
I think you would call it gothic. I mean, the one I'm writing is not quite as gothic as the real Rebecca, but we have someone who has died in mysterious circumstances, and we have a brooding housekeeper, and we have the dark house on the clifftops, and so that's kind of fun to write, you
mm-hmm.
know, because if you've read Rebecca first, you can pick up all little tiny nuances that I put in the book.
Uh-huh.
And that, oh, that's why she said that, you know. So
yes.
So I'm enjoying writing that.
How fun.
Yeah.
Different.
And it's going to be called The Last Mrs. Summers, which, as you know, if you've read...
S-O-M-M?
No, Summers, as in S-U-M-M-E-R-S.
Okay.
And, of course, the Rebecca, she's always known as the second Mrs. De Winter.
Right.
So, yes.
I see the combination.
Yes.
You're having fun with this,
I'm having
you?
Fun with
yes,
it, yes.
Yes,
yeah.
yes, yes.
Yeah, I have fun with this whole series, you know.
Right.
I think because they're meant to be, you know, they're lighthearted and... there's a lot of satire, British class system and everything. So I enjoy. I call out to my husband, hey, listen to what Queenie just said. Listen to this. I think it's great fun because I chuckle when I write.
Right.
Yeah.
That's fun.
Yes.
That should be. That's the way writing should be.
It should be, yes. Yeah.
You don't want to – I know it's a task, but you don't want it to be taking over your life.
Yeah. Well, that's why I didn't do the big, dark standalone, because that would have made me depressed.
Mm-hmm. As you have discovered during the previous hour, there may not be tigers or bears on today's Word by Word, but there were lots of hungry lions, charging elephants, ravenous army ants. We didn't talk about them very much.
We didn't, no.
And both animal and human kinds of cheetahs, and that could also be said as cheaters, right?
Yeah. Could.
We did talk about them.
We did, yes.
Since our guest is the New York Times multiple bestseller and winner of over 20 writing awards, Reese Bowen, with her latest mystery novel, Life and Death Among the Cheetahs. Our studio engineer is Adia White. Station manager is Sean Knight. Radio coordinator is Wendy Nicholson. Podcast archivist is Mark Prell. Our theme music is by Bill Conti, and I am your host, Gil Manser. Before we sign off, I want to take a moment to mention the death of mystery novelist Sarah Andrews. A longtime colleague and friend, Sarah was one of my first guests on Word by Word, where she talked about writing her award-winning series about forensic geologist M. Hansen, including Bone Hunter, Fault Line, and Rock Bottom. Sadly, Sarah, her husband Damon Brown, and their 25-year-old son Duncan perished when their twin-engine airplane crashed into a Nebraska field. Everyone involved with Word by Word conversations with writers from Northern California Public Media, KRCB FM, wants to thank you for your continued support and invite you to our next Word by Word broadcast at 4 p.m. Sunday, September 15th, when our guest will be the illustrious physicist and novelist Ransom Stevens with his new techno thriller, Too Rich to Die. Until then, here's how Reese Bowen introduced her indefatigable sleuth in her first book of the series, Her Royal Spinus, back in 2007. Can you read that?
Her ridiculously long name is Lady Victoria Georgiana Charlotte Eugenie, daughter of the Duke of Athelton Rannoch, and she is flat broke. As the 34th in line for the throne, she's been taught only a few things, among them the perfect curtsy. But when her brother cuts off her allowance, she leaves Scotland and her fiancé, Fishface, for London. When an arrogant Frenchman who wants her family's 800-year-old estate for himself winds up dead in her bathtub. Now her most important job is to clear her very long family name.